Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big new report from the President's Cancer Panel says cancer caused by carcinogens in our living environment is grossly underestimated. Cancer from products and chemicals in our everyday lives. Their letter to President Obama urges him, quote, most strongly to use the power of your office to remove the carcinogens and other toxins from our food, water, and air that needlessly increase health care costs, cripple our nation's productivity, they write, and devastate American lives. This hour on Point, why we get cancer and our environment. We'll talk with one of the authors of the new report. You can join the conversation. Have you wondered whether pesticides, household cleaners, everyday plastics could be giving us cancer? How much evidence do we need before we regulate or ban? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Houston, Texas, is Margaret Kripke, immunologist and professor and chair emerita at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. She's one of two sitting members of the President's Cancer Panel, a panel established in 1971 to advise the White House on cancer policy. Their new report out last week is Reducing Environmental Cancer Risk, What We Can Do Now. Margaret Kripke, Dr. Kripke, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me today.
So you come right in saying that we've grossly underestimated exactly what has been underestimated, Dr. Kripke.
Well, there's a figure that has been quoted widely and is still quoted today that environmental factors contribute about 6% to the cancer burden. And we are convinced that, first of all, is very out of date. This report was published in 1981, and so no one has really looked at this situation for the last 30 years. So we think it's time that someone take a new look at this, and the reason that we think it's underestimated is that a lot has happened in the last 30 years. As you know, the use of medical x-rays, for example, has increased hugely in the last few years. And we are continually putting more and more chemicals into our environments. So we wanted a call to action to take a look at this issue again, even though it might constitute only a majority of cancers. Even a few cancers are a few too many.
I want to be sure I understand this. So 6%, does that mean when you said the cancer burden, does that mean 6% of cancer cases? Is the sort of standing number tied back to these environmental factors rather than smoking or something else?
That's correct.
6%. Now, we've got about 1.5 million American men and women and children diagnosed with cancer just last year in 2009. More than 500,000. 562,000 Americans died from cancer last year. If it's not 6%, do you have any idea? Did you do any work on what portion of those cancer cases and deaths it might be?
No, and that's one of the recommendations in our report. We recommend very strongly that we need to take a new look at this question. And no one really knows today what the burden of environmental factors is on the cancer problem. So we need some better estimates of how much of our cancer, how many of our cancer cases are actually coming from the environment. And today we really don't know that. But based on the testimony that we heard, we believe it to be much larger than that.
If the standing presumption is way low, what about the, even with the standing number, what about the other 94%? How is it typically sort of parsed out in terms of what portion of cancer comes from what kind of causes?
Well, that's an important question. The President's Cancer Panel in 2007 did a report on lifestyle factors in cancer, and it's estimated that about 30% of all cancers are due to tobacco use in this country.
Okay.
So that clearly has the largest single impact on the cancer burden is tobacco use. The other factor that we examined was obesity, nutrition, and exercise. And the estimates there are that perhaps as many as 20% of the cancers are due to that those kinds of factors. But that still leaves us with a fairly large percentage of cancers that are unidentified. There's a very small fraction of cancers that are due to genetic causes, but that's very small, 1% or less. And so there's a lot of room here for estimating other factors that might be involved.
So your conclusion, as you write, along with your, I should say that this is a three-person panel historically since 1971, or formally. It just so happens that there are two on it right now. When were you appointed, and by what, in what administration, Dr. Kripke?
I was appointed by the President Bush, 43, mm-hmm. number 43.
W.
Yes, George W. And
your co-member, Dr. LaSalle LaFall Jr., was appointed
yes,
by?
Also by George W. Bush.
All right. You say that Americans are facing grievous harm from chemicals in air, food, and water that have largely gone unregulated and ignored. Begin to walk us in there. Like what, Doctor?
Well, we know that there are cancer-causing substances in the workplace that are not being regulated. We know that there are substances that are suspected, or there's for which there's evidence that they are cancer-causing, that are not people are not being protected against. And there are large numbers of chemicals in our environment where we have no idea whether they are harmful or not. We have reason to believe that many of the components of pesticides, for example, are harmful, and yet the public and people who work in agriculture are widely exposed to those chemicals. So I think that raising some attention to this issue is really important. This is an area that has been pretty neglected in terms of research and public attention for the last 30 years.
We'll look at what has been done and what might be done there, but I wish you'd take us through in very concrete terms. I mean, I think people think about this a lot, and I think they think about their daily lives a lot. You're saying in our food, in our air, in our water, just as concrete and specific as you can about what kinds of sources that people might be coming into contact with in their everyday life of this threat.
Well, there is increasing evidence that certain components of plastics leach out of the plastic and get into water and into food. And I think the public needs to be aware of those.
So is that plastic packaging that food would come in, or plastic that we store and cook food in?
Store and cook, I think, are the most the areas of most concern.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that in the process of disinfecting water sources, in some cases there are byproducts of the disinfection process that are likely to be cancer-causing.
Do you mean in the public water supply that our tap was going to draw?
Yes, that's right. And so one of our recommendations is to simply put a filter on your tap water, and to that will remove many of the potential contaminants in water sources.
Most people don't have that kind of filter, so this will get people's attention in a hurry. Is this in all public water supplies or just some?
No, just some, actually. It depends on how the disinfection process, what disinfection process is used for which water source. And I'm not arguing against disinfecting water, because disinfecting water is very important for the public health, because we don't want microbes and other bacteria and so on in our water supply. So we have to have disinfection. But the cost of that sometimes is to have byproducts of the disinfection process that are not 100% safe. But there's, as I say, there's a simple way of mitigating that by simply mm-hmm. putting a filter on your water faucet.
There's plastics and drinking water. What about food and air, you say?
With food, we know that there are cancer-causing substances that are created when meat is cooked at high temperature, particularly if you're barbecuing and you cook things that are very well done. Mm-hmm. There are chemicals that are made in the meat while it's cooking that are actually cancer-causing. This has been known for a very long time, actually. And so, again, another simple recommendation is not to overcook red meat if you're cooking at home, if you're barbecuing.
Other chemicals that may be there in the meat, are you saying stay away, you know, go, it's, food should be organic?
No.
Fertilizer, pesticides?
No, it has nothing to do with food additives. It has to do with what happens to meat when it's cooked at very high temperature.
No, but I mean, you're also pointing at pesticides, and I believe some fertilizers and antibiotics that would enter the food chain.
That certainly is possible. And the way that I think about this is that if I think of how many environmental chemicals I was exposed to as a child compared to what my grandchildren are experiencing today, it's pretty huge in terms of the increase in things that are in our environment. For example, we didn't have an exterminator, and we didn't use pesticides in our garden. And so a lot of things have changed over the last 30 years that we believe people should be looking at, and we should have enough research to know whether we're safe or we're not.
You say, to a disturbing extent, you're right, babies today are born pre-polluted, meaning?
That there have been studies done looking at cord blood, which is the blood that comes from the umbilical cord when babies are born, and the blood in the umbilical cord has been tested for a variety of chemicals and medications, drugs, so on. And there have certainly been reports that this blood is contaminated to a large extent. In fact, the Center for Disease Control is currently doing a study on that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about why we get cancer and a new report that says dangerous chemicals in our environment, in our everyday lives, and food and water and air are a much bigger factor than we've been told. Dr. Margaret Kripke joins us this hour from Houston, Texas. She's one of the members of the President's Cancer Panel. This was formed in 1971, back under Richard Nixon. She and her fellow panel member, there are only two on the three-person panel at the moment, Dr. LaSalle LaFall Jr., both appointees of George W. Bush, President Bush, have just come out with a big new report called Reducing Environmental Cancer Risk, What We Can Do Now, where they've said that the incidence of cancer from environmental causes is grossly underestimated in our current accounting. Let's get a call right here from Charlottesville, Virginia. Paige, you're on the air with Margaret Kripke.
Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Kripke, I would like for you to address a little bit more the issue between the link of nutrition, pesticide use, and cancer, and just the possibility that the soil in this country is so depleted. That coupled with the use of pesticides, certainly the nutritional value of food has gone down, which makes our immune systems less able to deal with the use of chemicals in our foods. And the use of chemicals certainly in agribusiness is so great, and research that's been done on the effects of pesticides on plants, weeds in particular, of course, herbicides not being left out of this debate, and insects, and also small animals. And I just wonder about what research is being done and the correlation between all of those things and the human consumption of food and cancer.
Paige, thanks for your call. Dr. Kripke, what do you say?
Well, I think we need a lot more information about that. It's very difficult to determine how much those things contribute to cancer in the general population. But I think it is worrisome that we have increased pesticide use. I think it's troublesome that there are so many different chemicals that are contained within both pesticides and fertilizers that are clearly making their way into the food chain. So I think one important thing that can be done is to make sure that that fresh fruits and vegetables and things are actually washed before they're used. That certainly helps to some extent. But I think that we need a lot more work to look at what is the relationship of those factors to the cancer burden.
A big part of the focus of the report seems to be saying we're almost deliberately avoiding focusing on some of this potential research.
Well, part of that comes from the fact that we don't want to detract from the fact that tobacco use is the biggest cancer cause in our country. And so people are reluctant to focus on this issue because they don't want to take away the focus on nutrition, diet, and exercise, tobacco use, things that people can do for themselves that's likely to have a really large impact. Also, I think it's troublesome to come out with a public message that makes people feel like they're living in an ocean of toxic toxic chemicals and they are helpless to deal with that. So I think that's some of the reasons why this has been avoided.
Though your report could easily give a person just that impression. Interesting that the American Cancer Society came out kind of in dissent. I mean, they said, yes, they shared your concerns about exposure to chemicals, so many chemicals, lack of information about those chemicals, vulnerability of children, radiation risks from medical imaging tests. But they brought out Dr. Michael Thune, epidemiologist from the Cancer Society, who said that your report was unbalanced by its implication that pollution is the major cause of cancer, and presented as an unproven theory, the idea that environmentally caused cases are grossly underestimated as if it were fact.
Well, I think the American Cancer Society's response focused on points of disagreement rather than the points of agreement. I think we are in agreement with the American Cancer Society about many of the issues in our report. But the issue of the estimates and whether they're the current estimates and whether they're grossly underestimated is one that we feel very strongly about based on the hours and hours of testimony from experts that we heard. And so, again, the current estimates that are being used were published in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
We have now about 80,000 chemicals that are being manufactured and are in people's homes today. And much of that has occurred in the last 30 years. So I think that to think that any of these factors is going to reduce the amount, reduce that estimate is probably unwarranted. So I think that we ought to be erring on the side of caution in terms of putting more things into our environment rather than saying, oh, it's only 6%, let's don't worry about that. You know, if you're one of the 6%, it's really an important issue.
Of course, there's a matter of emphasis here, but these are important matters of emphasis. Dr. Margaret Kipke, on the President's Cancer Panel, one of the two authors of this big new report, please stand by in Houston. I want to get another perspective here for a moment, if I may, from St. Louis, Missouri. We're joined by Dr. Graham Kolditz, epidemiologist, associate director of prevention and control at the Siteman Cancer Center at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Dr. Kolditz, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So I believe you said that you think the President's panel is sort of steering the conversation in the wrong direction here. Why?
Well, I think that the real challenge with cancer prevention is putting in perspective all the factors that we know are driving our rates of cancer in the United States and many other Western countries. And the concern is that by making this statement that there's this gross underestimate and really focusing on that rather than many of the other positive steps to follow that the panel has outlined, we're really steering the public and their perceptions and their likelihood of action away from things that we know could dramatically reduce our cancer burden if we acted on them right now. And so it's getting this perspective that I think is missing at the moment and is really fundamental to moving prevention forward for cancer control in this country.
The president's panel, Dr. Kripke, says, look, our current understanding of cancer linked to environmental causes goes all the way back to 1981. It's only 6%. Things have changed a lot during those years. It may be grossly underestimated. Just on its merits, what do you make of that assertion or that fear?
The assertion is partly wrong because, in fact, the estimates have been updated. We updated these in a group at the Harvard School of Public Health and published an update back in 1996. And the World Health Organization in 2005 published another review of the global estimates of occupational exposures. Another WHO group published a review of environmental risk and cancer. And all of these updated reports still come back to the 4 to 6% figure based on the latest science that these groups are putting together. So while the number may still be in the range of what Dol and Pedo projected, and of course they had a level of uncertainty with their projection, if anything, I think the data has made us more certain as to the known carcinogens in the environment, the regulatory policies in place to control them in the workplace and so on. And the long-term benefit of that is starting to accrue, whether we look at asbestos exposure or many other traditional occupational exposures. They're now well under control in the workplace setting where some of the highest exposures have historically occurred.
And yet we had 1.5 million people getting cancer last year. Dr. Koldis, for people listening right now, who I'm sure are paying very close attention to this, where would you advise them to place the bulk of their attention and concern, vigilance, when it comes to avoiding cancer?
Great question. And we've outlined multiple times now the tobacco, as Dr. Kripke said, approximately a third of all cancers in the United States. Overweight, another 20%, very strong data from around the world showing that this obesity and overweight driving many cancers. Infection is, in fact, driving about 8% of cancer in the United States.
What kind of infection do you mean?
We have hepatitis infection causing liver cancer. We have the virus that causes cancer of the cervix in women, and then there are other viruses that cause lymphoma. So globally, that percentage is actually much bigger because cervical cancer is a bigger problem where there are not PAP programs and so
right,
on
right.
in developing countries. And so after that, we get to medication and alcohol, sun exposure, and all of those together really give us, more than 60% of cancer could be prevented today if we actually acted on what we know.
I don't know how we solve a kind of a medical difference of perspective like this in this kind of forum, but Margaret Kripke, that's quite a long list. And what I hear is Graham Koldis, Dr. Koldis, putting environmental factors after all of those. Does that mean, we shouldn't get so worked up?
Well, I think, as Dr. Koldis mentioned, what we know accounts for about 60% of cancer incidents.
Mm-hmm.
There's another 40% out there where we don't know. And so the 6% of chemicals has quite a ways to go in terms of being larger. If the impact is larger than 6%, there's a lot of room in there for attributing cancer to other causes.
Dr. Koldis at Washington University, School of Medicine, we're very grateful to you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let me invite in now, if I may, from Portland, Maine, Sandra Steingraber. She's ecologist, author, and cancer survivor herself. She testified before the President's Cancer Panel for this new report on environmental cancer risk. The Sierra Club calls her the new Rachel Carson, as in Silent Spring's Rachel Carson. She's author of Living Downstream, an Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer and the Environment, subject of a new documentary film based on that book. You can see a trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. Sandra Steingraber, thank you very much for being with us. What do you make of the new report?
Hello. Hi, Tom. It's nice to be here. I think the report is an amazing document, and its probably greatest contribution is that it has broken the sort of official silence around the topic of the environment and cancer and the demonstrable evidence for that link. And it lays out the evidence, many hundreds of citations from the scientific literature. That's probably its greatest achievement. And, of course, when I reviewed some of that same literature in my own book, Living Downstream, I reached some of the same conclusions.
What was your personal experience here? Are you confirmed in the belief that your own cancer was caused by environmental factors?
Well, I can say this. You know, I'm a biologist, and so therefore I know I'm a sample size of one, and cancer is a disease of multiple causation. But what I can say is that I was diagnosed with bladder cancer at the age of 20. It was questions from my own diagnosing physician while I was still lying there exhaling anesthesia who prompted me to think about the environmental contributions of my disease. He asked me, had I ever been exposed to vulcanized tires? Had I ever smelted aluminum or dealt with textile dyes? And when back in the medical library as a young biologist, I began to take a look at the environmental links to bladder cancer and indeed found that it was considered a quintessential environmental cancer. My own aunt went on to die of the same kind of bladder cancer that I had. My mother had breast cancer at the same time I had bladder cancer. So there's a lot of cancer in my family. However, the punchline to my story is that I'm adopted. And so I began to think about all the things that families also have in common besides their chromosomes, and that often consists of drinking water supplies, food chain issues, and air supplies. And so that became my life's work as a biologist. And so I testified before the cancer panel as a biologist. I presented some of my own research on pesticides and their link to breast cancer. But when I read this report, I actually read it as a cancer patient. The questions this report poses are the same questions my own physician asked me at the moment of my diagnosis. And happily, this report goes a long way in giving us some answers.
Margaret Kripke, Dr. Kripke, one of the things you point out is that other countries are much more kind of aggressive in precautionary steps when it comes to these environmental factors. Could you give us some examples of that, and why is the United States not?
Well, this is a public policy decision, and in our country, we tend to wait until there's evidence that something is harmful before we regulate it or take it off the market. In some of the European countries, they use a precautionary approach which says that demonstrate that this substance is not harmful before you put it out into the public domain. So there are many differences in terms of things that are available in our country versus what's available in European countries.
80,000 chemicals out there, what portion of them tested or reviewed for potential cancer-causing qualities?
Only a few hundred, and of course that's one of the major issues, is that we don't have adequate testing even procedures, methodologies for dealing with that huge backlog of chemicals that are already out there that we don't know anything about. And so one of the recommendations we've made is that we need a lot of research and some new testing methods that keep us from having to test one chemical at a time. If we only have to test one chemical at a time, we're never going to get there. So we need new methodologies here to deal with these issues.
Sandra, sometimes I wonder, I mean, we want to know and then maybe we don't. If we kind of don't want to know what's in the environment because it sounds so overwhelming to try and address it or live within that.
Well, I think the environmental story of cancer is actually a hopeful one. You know, if the evidence had shown us, which happily it does not, that heredity was our main driving engine of cancer, and the report very clearly lays out that only 5% of cancers are attributable to genetic factors alone, then I would feel depressed because, after all, there's nothing we can do about our ancestors. On the other hand, people put chemicals into the environment. People can take them out. And so what the report shows us is that preventing cancer from protecting people from what causes cancer is a reasonable place to begin a program of cancer control.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about why we get cancer. and a new report that says dangerous chemicals in our environment are a much bigger factor than we've been told. Margaret Kripke is with us. She's one of the members of the President's Cancer Panel, one of the two who came out with this big new report, and it's getting a lot of attention. But you can read the whole report at our website, onpointradio.org. Sandra Steingraber is with us as well from Portland, Maine. She's author of Living Downstream, an Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer and the Environment. Cancer hit her at age 20, and she's looking at environmental reasons. Let's go to Dave in Stowe, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great great program and a great lead-in to what I have, my comment.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the cancer risks we've been talking about here are lifestyle choices and therefore are more or less under our individual control. And certainly while I believe we need to continue to encourage people to exercise, not use tobacco, and not drink excessively,
yeah,
I also think it's unfair for those of us who've tried to minimize our risks by following a good lifestyle, a healthy lifestyle, to not have the answers to the chemical exposure issue. I mean, if I exercise and do all these things, maybe chemical exposure is 80 or 90% of my actual risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've made a choice if you haven't done. I don't want to appear callous, but if you're sedentary and you smoke, you've made a choice that, you know, you may get cancer. What about you know, those of us who are trying to be healthy and additionally the legacy we're leaving behind?
That is an interesting perspective. Sandra Steingraber, how do you respond to that? Those who like do all the right things, don't smoke, watch out for sun, you know, don't go overweight. Dave looks at this remaining risk, which may be 6% or who knows what portion of that 40 or 50% it entails, and says this is unfair.
Well, I consider myself in the same club, I guess. I was the clean living winner of the Elks Club scholarship when I was diagnosed with a disease that's considered a quintessential environmental cancer. And all lines of evidence pointed to drinking water contamination as the possible cause. And indeed, I was able to confirm that there are bladder carcinogens that periodically show up in my hometown drinking water wells. But if my diagnosing physician hadn't asked me the right questions that led me to understand my disease as an environmental disease, I would not have gone off and discovered that research. And mm-hmm. I have to say, I find it condescending, actually, to be told as a cancer patient that we can't tell the public about the data that we in the scientific community have about the environmental causes of cancer because it will be distracting. You know, when we tell children about the dangers of child abduction, we don't not tell them to not get in cars with strangers because most child abductions happen by family members. You know, we still tell our kids to not take candy from strangers. So if children can understand the concept of multiple causation, surely cancer patients can as well. And the other thing I find slightly irritating about this whole numbers game is that, 500,000 people a year die of cancer. If only 6% of us are those that get environmental or die of environmental causes, that's still, if you do the math, 30,000 people. And if, as Dr. Kripke suggests, it could be upwards of 40%, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people at that point. You know, even 30,000 people is more than the number of suicides every year in the United States. And we have suicide hotline numbers in the front of every phone book. Why don't we have cancer prevention hotlines in the front of every phone book?
Dr. Kripke, our caller Dave is pretty good on the numbers here too. I mean, he's looking, saying, okay, if you take away the major risk factors, smoking, overweight, and the rest, if you could, you know, live in such a way that the cause of maybe 60% of cancers should not be in your lap, then these environmental things could be, as Dave says, 80% of your risk, or who knows, but pretty high.
Well, I think some of the research that's going on at the moment shows very clearly that there are interactions between what genes you have and things that are in your environment. So I think as we learn more about gene-environment interactions, we will be able to unravel this a little better. It's true that not everybody who smokes gets lung cancer. And so some people are genetically predisposed to get lung cancer from smoking. And I think the same will undoubtedly be true of other environmental factors in terms of a genetic component and an environmental component, which both together go to increase an individual's cancer risk. So I think it's a very important perspective.
Let's go to Clarksville, Tennessee, and Janelle. Janelle, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about, well, I don't ever hear any talk of the synergistic effects of the chemicals that we're exposed to. You know, the simultaneous action between multiple chemicals and the total effect being much greater than their individual effects, you know, and there's so much focus put on just individual things like the smoking or
right.
or the pesticides or, you know, the toxins in the workplace, but there's not any talk of the whole soup that is inside of us. And
that's a very interesting point. Let us pick it up, Janelle, and I thank you for it. Dr. Kripke, Janelle's right. I mean, you know, I guess we sort of become the beaker in which all these things are mixed together. What about the – is there a synergistic effect or risk?
Well, that's really a very, very important question, and thank you for asking it. One of the problems, we don't talk very much about it, is that there's not a lot known about it. And there are a few studies showing things are additive. There are some suggestions that they're, when you mix more than one thing together, it's more than additive, but there's not a huge amount of evidence for that. So I think it is seriously a concern that the estimates of you know, how many cancers are due to environmental agents really have not considered the multiple exposures that people actually have. I thought that was a very, very excellent question.
Sandra Steingraber, how do you try and protect yourself from these environmental risks? I mean, you must be exquisitely attuned. It's some years now since you had your bout, but of course that can and you can return. You must be really attuned to this.
Well, indeed, bladder cancer, of all human cancers, is the one most likely to recur. I take an upstream approach to cancer. I'm also a mother. I became a cancer patient at 20 and a mother at the brink of 40.
Mm-hmm.
And so I certainly practice the precautionary principle in my own life. But frankly, as a working mom, I can't be my own regulatory agency. I can't check every single website, you know, every time my kids come home with a birthday goodie bag. And so what I really am interested in is my own government taking a close look at this evidence and engaging in meaningful chemical reform based on that. I don't think toxicity should be a choice. I think we all deserve protection, whether we can afford water filters or not. And I think the president's cancer panel really lays out the case for moving upstream, engaging in chemical reform, and embracing green chemistry and green engineering so we can get some of these bad actor chemicals out of our economy. It was amazing to me as a young cancer patient to learn that certain chemicals are known to cause bladder cancer, and we've had absolute proof on this in some cases for 100 years, and yet nothing has been done in our regulatory agencies to divorce our economy from its ongoing dependencies on this.
Well, why not? Is it industry power, or is it the politicians fear that citizens don't want to be hassled with the changes? Why do you think we have not been more proactive, precautionary in this country?
Well, I'm interested in that question. I'm not sure I have the answers. I'm exquisitely aware that, for example, the Canadian Cancer Society, which is our counterpart to the American mm-hmm. Cancer Society, has a much different approach to this kind of evidence and has served as a more powerful environmental champion. So I think one of the obstacles in the United States is the reluctance of our big cancer control agencies to look at the evidence that this report has laid out. The Canadian Cancer Society, by contrast, took a leading role in Canada in the province-wide bans of lawn chemicals on the grounds that although there's not absolute proof, there's troubling evidence to link exposure of kids to pesticides and pediatric tumors such as leukemias and brain cancers. And so because of the kind of prestige and power of the Canadian Cancer Society, that their argument was very convincing. I would hope that the American Cancer Society would be eager to protect children and the president's cancer panel has a wonderful graph, for example, showing the rise of cancer rates among children from the 1970s to the present. And, of course, infants and children at the age of 2 who have leukemia and brain cancers, they don't smoke, drink, or hold stressful mm-hmm. jobs. You know, we can't invoke lifestyle explanations to explain that increase.
But they're born, as the report says, pre-polluted. What a terrible phrase. Margaret Kripke, how do you interpret the institutional resistance to change on this front, to a more proactive stance? Is it primarily industry? Is it government? Is it just, lethargy, habit?
It's hard to say, and I think it's probably multifactorial, but I think industry does have a lot of influence in what gets regulated and what doesn't. And, of course, if it's going to cost industries money, I think that's certainly a disincentive for them to do anything about it, and a disincentive for the government to actually do something about it. I want to emphasize a point that Sandra made, mm-hmm. which is that about children, because I think this is vitally important. Children are more vulnerable to these kind of environmental agents than are adults, and I think that's a point that most people don't realize, and so it's very, very important to protect children.
Let's go to Michael in Ashford, Connecticut. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a cancer survivor or remission person, and I presented 5 years ago with colon cancer stage four that had metastasized to my liver and other organs. And I have no cancer in a very extensive family tree. And I've had a lot of treatment at teaching hospitals and whatnot, and it just is, I've been bemused that no one has been interested in using me as a subject in even just a database sort, where it must be easy to get a bunch of people who have a largely genetic illness who have no background. You know, I would think we'd be fertile ground for environmental epidemiology.
So do some epidemiology right here, you say, on your case. Dr. Kripke, what about it? With 1.5 million Americans a year getting cancer, one would think that that's a huge opportunity to kind of sort out what's happening. Michael says nobody's ever, lifted a finger to look at his case in that way, as far as he knows.
Part of the problem is that most people who have colon cancer are in the same boat that he is, which is that they have colon cancer or breast cancer without any family history. And so I think that is the majority of cases, not the minority.
I see.
We do use statistical data from everyone who has cancer. His cancer has been recorded in a national database, so that's how we know that what the incidence of cancer is in the United States. So, and interviewing a single individual is not, is not that informative. You have to interview hundreds of people like that to try to find some commonalities in terms of what they've been exposed to, what they've eaten, and so on. So it's a little bit more complicated problem than I think we realize.
Michael, we wish you luck. Let's go to Jackson in Wayland, Massachusetts. Jackson, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am an environmental expert and been very concerned about lawn care chemical. And it seems that lawn care chemical is one of the most widespread things that affects children, dogs, the elderly, our environment, and it's just not being addressed.
And a whole lot of people pulling it out right now out of the garage or the store.
Sure, and you don't need lawn care chemical. You can have a healthy organic lawn that looks just as good as a chemical lawn. You can substitute a top-spreading compost. You can substitute organic fertilizer. The problem is lawn care chemical outside photodegrades over time in sunlight, but if you bring it in on your feet or your shoes or your dog brings it in the house on the pads of their paws, it stays in the house outside of UV light. It can last in the environment and pollute you in different ways for up to a year. There's many countries that don't have that don't allow lawn care chemical in public lands like Canada.
But we sure do. Our time is short, Jackson, if you permit me. I'm sorry, but let us pick it up. Dr. Kripke, what about lawn care chemicals?
I think that's a fantastic observation, and I think we should try to get lawn care pesticides out of public use, because I think they are dangerous. They've been demonstrated to be toxic.
Do you mean the fertilizers or the herbicides or what?
Herbicides, pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
And the point about tracking them in your house and having kids playing on the lawn and so on, I think is really very critical.
Wow. I don't know what to make of that. Sandra Steingraber, you know, there's so much of that that will probably go on this weekend. I mean, it's just a part of our system. It's just a part of American life. Can we really turn this environmental piece around? Do you have some optimism in the midst of this ocean of chemicals?
I'm absolutely optimistic, Tom. I mean, I'm a cancer survivor, so I've learned how to bring hope into times of great desperation, I guess, and I bring the same approach to cancer prevention. Rachel Carson said 50 years ago that DDT had taken on the harmless aspect of the familiar. Every housewife had a can underneath the sink, and we even put DDT in house paint so the flies would die as soon as they landed on your wall. And now we recognize that as a hazard, and if you've discovered a can of DDT in your basement now, you would call the hazmat unit. And I think in a similar way, we've taken on this sort of, we see these lawn chemicals as familiar things, and we ask how can they be harmful? In fact, you know, there is evidence for harm, and the Canadians have already gone a long way in outlawing lawn chemicals. I was in Toronto not so long ago. They still have beautiful style French gardens. They're just managed organically, and I think we can do that too.
It's been a great eye-opener today. Sandra Steingraber, author of Living Downstream, an ecologist's personal investigation of cancer and the environment. Look for the new documentary based on the film, and you can see the trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. Sandra, thank you very much for being with us from Portland, Maine today.
My pleasure.
And in Houston, Texas, Dr. Margaret Kripke, member of the President's Cancer Panel, co-author of the new report, Reducing Environmental Cancer Risk, What We Can Do Now. You can see the full report at the website as well. Dr. Kripke, you are brave, and we appreciate your standing up and speaking out and joining us today. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for airing this program. I think it's extremely important.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.